and welcome to the Marine Biological Association's podcast, The Marine Biologist. This podcast is the accompaniment to our magazine, also called The Marine Biologist, and it explores the current issues that face our ocean. If you'd like to find out more about the Marine Biological Association, or where you can get your hands on the Marine Biologist magazine, then please visit our website, www.mba.ac.uk. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Marine Biologist podcast. In this edition, we're going to be talking about predator aggregations. That's those spectacular gatherings of some of the most charismatic animals in the ocean, dolphins, sharks, billfish, and so on, when they come together to feed on shoals of small fish. And we're really excited to be joined today by Alicia Burns, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the Humboldt University in Berlin, part of the Science of Intelligence cluster. Also with us today is Lizzie Gibson-Hall, who's the training and events coordinator here at the MBA. So welcome, Alicia, and hi, Lizzie.
Hi, thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Hi, both. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Alicia is joining us to talk about the article that appeared in the July edition of the magazine, which is called First the Feast. And Alicia led on the writing of that, and it's a really exciting topic. And we're going to be talking about that today. Yeah, Alicia, can you give us an outline of the research group you work in and what you do?
Yes. So I, as you mentioned, I'm part of a bigger sort of cluster here in Berlin called the Science of Intelligence Cluster. And I guess from the top down, what the cluster is interested in is different types of intelligence throughout the animal kingdom, but also throughout things like synthesized intelligence, things like robots and artificial intelligence and things like that. But getting smaller and smaller, what my interest is in is intelligence in the animal world. And what we're doing in my team, so working with Professor Jens Krauser in Berlin and a few other postdocs and PhD students and things, what we're really interested in is this idea of collective shepherding and collective herding. So how groups of animals, in our case, striped marlin, which I'm sure we'll talk about, how they interact, but also how they herd other groups of animals, so bait balls of herring or sardines or things like that. So these are, it seems as quite a common occurrence. You see these big groups of predators, as you mentioned, and these spectacular aggregations of animals in the open ocean, but how they actually work together and you know, manipulate the prey school is a really complex question. So we actually don't know how they do it, and it's actually a really intelligent behavior. So my end of the cluster of intelligence is trying to understand how animals do these really complex intelligence behaviors and seeing if we can understand just the basic patterns and the rules that they do. So that's sort of the broad overview of what I'm interested in now. Yeah.
So thank you, Alicia. So you seem to have quite a specific field of research at the moment, but I wonder if you could give us a brief outline on your journey into marine biology.
Yes, I'll try and keep it brief because it's been quite circuitous, my route to sort of get here. So I actually did start out in marine science in my undergrad sort of life, but I was actually more interested in the physical sciences when I was young. So I sort of leaned towards things like oceanography and physics and that sort of end of the science. And I'll be perfectly honest, which is a plug for, I guess, students out there that maybe aren't having a loving undergrad. I didn't love undergrad at all. I really just, it wasn't for me. I didn't like sitting in lectures. I couldn't get my head around it. I just wanted to be out in the world. So I kind of left uni straight away after I finished my undergrad. I was like, nope, not for me, not interested. But I always had a fondness for the ocean and for the animals and all that sort of thing. So I took a few years. I took quite a few gap years, I think my parents called it at the time, and just traveled around and really got a taste for sort of the world and all the amazing things in it. And then kind of fell into it, to be honest, when I came back. So I was traveling for a few years, and I returned to Sydney, where I'm from in Australia. And a friend of mine from undergrad was actually doing his PhD in Sydney University doing marine science, and they needed a lab tech and I needed a part-time job while I was looking for a real job. So I just started doing that on the side and then instantly was like, oh yeah, this is for me. So stuck with it. Basically, I did finished my undergrad, did honours, and then sort of flowed into a PhD. But my PhD sort of started not on marine science, but I was actually looking more at behavior. So I guess I call myself a behavioral biologist in that sense. I'm interested in the behavior, and I use the marine world and all its amazing complexity and diversity to study behaviors of different animals. So that's how I sort of got into it. I had my PhD, I was super lucky to be able to go to the Great Barrier Reef and study a few different types of fish, just to test these sort of behavioral questions and social questions, and that sort of led me here.
Thanks, Alicia. Going on to the research you describe in the magazine, that spectacular cover image that readers would have seen of a striped marlin herding a shoal of fish. Isn't it scary getting into the water with big predators zooming around?
Yes. I'll be the first to admit I'm a massive coward. It's spectacular, as you say, that you have these sort of 1.5 metre, 2 metre long predatory fish with a big weapon on their face going incredibly fast. But what you realise as soon as you jump in, obviously the adrenaline is huge, but you realise that they are just not at all interested in you. They've got one, they're on a one track to the bait ball. It's going to be worse for them if they hit you than it is if you hit them. But it is. You've always got to be wary as well. There's always predators in the sea. So I'm always, got my eyes sort of scanning to see if there's any big grey shadows lurking underneath. But once you're in there and you're in it, you kind of feel a part of the scene. So it's such an adrenaline rush. This massive dynamic predators just swirling all directions all around you. And it's so fast that you kind of can't get your head around it. A colleague of mine, Matt Hansen, who's on this project as well, said the first time he jumped in with these blue marlins, he got out and he just couldn't stop laughing because it was just so incredible what they'd just seen. So, yeah, it's definitely scary. I won't be shy about saying that. I'm always wary of when I jump in the big blue ocean, but, it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, an amazing experience. And you mentioned in the article there are other dangers, aren't there, not just the animals in the sea?
Yeah. I've never got my sea legs. I'll be the first to admit that as well. As far as marine biologists go, I do not have my sea legs at all. So I get seasick like anything else. But also the weather is always a problem, those sorts of things. There's also other predators around. So there's lots of sea lions. We're not sure if we've highlighted the importance of those in the interaction. They don't seem to bother with people too much, but there's also fishermen. There's a real big sports fishing there. So you'll see the sort of, they fly fish for blue marlin off Mexico where we actually film these bait balls. And so occasionally you'll see just a fly fishing boat go past you and then a big hook all of a sudden trailing into the water. So you've always got to be careful of those as well. It's a big spectacle and obviously a lot of people are interested in it.
It seems like a really exciting and quite dynamic situation, what you've just described. And I think we're wondering, how easy is it to actually collect the data if you've got all these other things, you need to be thinking about? How do you collect the data and how do you put it all together after you've collected it?
Yeah, it's a real team effort. It's actually evolved so much, even in just the last few years. I know when I was doing my PhD sort of only, I don't want to admit, maybe 10 years ago now, we were starting out with sort of very, not rudimentary, but quite basic underwater cameras. Even GoPros back then weren't as sort of high-tech as they are now. So we started out by just filming under the water with snorkeling gear, pointing a camera at the bait ball and seeing what we could get. And from that, we can actually get quite a lot. So we can quantify things like temporal aspects of the hunt, how quick the marlins come back after they've already had an attack, those sorts of things. But now what we're finding in the last few years is the advancement with drones. They've just gone, way faster. The technology has really taken off and so much more accessible, even just for tourism sort of purposes. So now what we're able to do is actually film from above and we get that really high definition spatial resolution, which is absolutely amazing. But that's only the first part of the problem. So we get this amazing footage both underwater and above the water, but what we really want for this project is to understand the fine scale movement characteristics. So we need trajectory information and more importantly, we need real world trajectories. So the way we've been doing that is really this big collaborative effort that we've been talking about. So we've got collaborators in Mexico. We've got collaborators in Germany, some in the UK as well. And we're working with people who are experts in sort of vision tracking, in computer scientists, all these sorts of drone operators, to try and sort of fix the drone in space and track what's happening underneath it. Yeah, so what we've actually been doing is working with computer science first, just to track the Marlin moving on the screen. And what they've been able to do is incredible. Is they've taught these sort of computer models to actually identify a Marlin when they see it on the screen and track it throughout our drone footage. And we've got hours and hours of footage now, which is spectacular. We can get this really long-term data. But obviously, that's only the first part. What we really want is that to be able to actually say it's moving, you know, this many meters per second, it's turning at this rate. And to do that, we really need to work with computer scientists. So one of the big problems with drone footage, especially on sea, is there's no landmarking. You can't actually tell where the drone is. And these hunts are so dynamic sometimes. You can see these bait balls just travel super fast that snorkelers can't keep up, but drones can, which has been a huge advantage to us as well. So we follow them for hours, and they just sort of, you know, we're chasing behind them trying to keep the drone and the boat kind of speeding after the bait ball. But that makes it a real challenge to then turn that into real world data. So at the moment, it's been sort of a year and a half of sort of plugging away using computer models, but we're really getting to the point now where we can actually localize that drone. Yeah, so we're getting to the point now. It's been about a year and a half on this project, trying to extract real-world data points. And we've had some amazing sort of physicists, mathematicians pulling it out for us. And we're just getting to the point where we're really extracting actual trajectory information, which has been amazing. So what we can do now with that trajectory from the drone, we can marry it up with the footage that we get underneath, where we can quantify an actual Marlin eating a sardine, which is amazing. So we can sort of marry the two data sets and actually get real world functional output. So we can see what the Marlin are doing around the bait ball spatially, and we can see what they're doing underwater temporally. So it's just this wealth of information. And what's so unique about this project is that this hasn't been done before, as far as we know. It's obviously an incredibly fast moving, hard to film sort of system, but it's also sporadic. So it happens about this time each year in Mexico, but it can vary. The numbers of Marlin can vary. The season can sort of shift. We know El Nino might play a big role. The last big El Nino that happened sort of a couple of years ago, the Marlin just weren't there. We think they were a bit more offshore. So this one is looking to be quite a big El Nino this season as well. So we're not even sure if they'll be there this year, but that's one of the big benefits of having collaborators in Mexico who can tell us what's happening on the ground. So, yeah, so it's this amazing data set that we really can actually look at the spatial temporal aspects of a hunt for the first time, rather than just sort of filming it, saying it's spectacular and not understanding what the actual fine scale movement patterns are. We can actually now start to really extract those, which is really exciting.
It's amazing. And I was wondering, does the computer ever, or does the visuals ever lose track of a particular individual? I mean, if it goes deep, can it recognize it again when it comes up by its sort of shape and size and patterns?
Yeah, that's one of the shortcomings, actually, is that we can't tell from the drone who the individuals are. So we do lose them. So we're looking at that sort of aspect of it as group level. It is good at picking individuals up, but yeah, like you say, they dive and we lose them. From the underwater footage, we can do that. We can tell them their stripe patterns and we can actually ID them, but not from above, which is a bit of a shame. But that said, we still get so much out of it. So, yeah, we don't really need the IDs at this stage, but that would be the next big challenge, I think.
I was going to ask, if you turn up at the right time of year as a whole team and you have to wait in Mexico, for example, if that's where the research is, and stand by in the season for things to happen.
Yeah, well, that actually happened last year. So in the past, we've just been lucky. We've sort of picked it. It's a general sort of fishing season as well. So there's a lot of sports fishing, wreck fishing going on there. So we can actually, you know, monitor social media even and see what's happening before we go. But last year, the whole team went for 2 weeks, but I only went for the second week. And the first week, they didn't see a single Marlin. So the day that I turned up, all the fish turned up. So I was super lucky, but I missed the bad week where they just wait around. But that's sort of the nature of it at the moment, is it's getting a bit sort of dicey on timing. So we try and go for as long as we can just to basically cover that. But it is a bit, it can be hit and miss, definitely.
So a hot topic at the moment is kind of around science communication and how we can communicate science to the general public. How do you explain the importance of your particular research to, say, you know, a person on the street or in the media?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's always one that I always struggle with, because to me it's just inherently interesting. You know, if you can show this footage of this amazing system that's happening and it looks so cool, don't you want to know how it works? That's the initial plug, because we don't really. We don't know how it works. We don't know how it happens. And just understanding that at a very basic bedrock sort of basic science level is super interesting to me. But I'm lucky that in terms of this project specifically, being a part of this sort of general cluster of intelligence, it actually has a bigger sort of interpretation. So we're actually really interested in this idea of collective intelligence and using the Marlin and the way that they actively coordinate as a form of intelligence in the wild. So a thing that's so super interesting about the Marlin is that they're usually solitary, but you get these big aggregations just of these juvenile Marlins. So they all come together and perform this sort of collective hunting, we call it. But then as they get bigger and turn into adults, they're back to solitary. So that sort of dynamic is a really interesting question, and understanding how they do it, we can then use that sort of basic rules of intelligence to better inform things like technology or systems. We can use the basic rules that we can then apply to other things.
Does your research also have sort of implications for fisheries management and things like that?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the big questions is what they do when they're not doing this. So where do they go? So we don't really know any of that sort of stuff. People tag them, obviously, but where these aggregations start, we don't know. They just sort of appear one day and then they're there. And that has huge implications for the management, not only of the marlin fishery. So that's a huge industry in itself, but ecotourism and sports fishing and wreck fishing and that sort of thing. But even the food that they're eating, so they're eating heron, Pacific sardines, that's a huge commercial fishery off Baja. So understanding that the dynamics between those two, just those two alone, is going to be huge implications for things like marine management, but also even just from an environmental aspect. So these fluctuations that we're seeing from climate change and from these El Nino and La Nina aspects really changes the way the fish aggregate and where they are. And so we need to understand that as well. And so understanding where they're behaving in these aggregates that we see sort of just once a year and how that sort of shifts over time throughout the years is super important, I think, for management, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Alicia. And with all this different teams in different locations, it must be really hard to keep everything on track. What are the challenges there?
Yeah, that's always a challenge, I think, with these bigger research questions is making sure everyone's sort of going towards the same goal. But one of the biggest bonuses of this project is actually that we've got such a diverse team, not just in terms of location, but in terms of speciality as well. So a lot of our colleagues in Mexico aren't marlin specialists. So we've got people working on phytoplankton, people working on the sea lions, and those. So they might have a different interest in what we're interested in, but the wealth of information that they can give us has been so, so important for understanding the system as a whole. So that's been really, really good. And just checking in with people is obviously the best way to move forward. So we've got obviously computer scientists and things working on the tracking aspect. They probably care less about the biology, which is fine. And so making sure that we're sort of heading towards the same goal on there has been a bit of a long learning curve, but a really rewarding one. So they've been able to show us aspects of just in terms of computer vision, what it can do, all these things that biologists, we don't really know about, these sort of technical things that are way above my head. They like to do all these fancy things, and we've been able to tap into it and use it to benefit our research, even just sort of on the side. So that's been a real bonus as well.
And how did you make sure that the sort of benefits of the research were going to be kind of equitably shared? I mean, you hear a lot about parachute science.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So we were really conscious of that before we actually started going there. You know, we don't want to just turn up and pretend that we know what we're doing and film some things and leave. So we got in touch with, we're actually really lucky with, there's an amazing research institute in La Paz in Baja, which is where we fly into, a big marine research center there with some amazing scientists doing really cool stuff. So we got in touch with them before we went, just to get an idea of what was happening with the system, to be honest. It was to see if we could get some of that sort of on-the-ground knowledge of what was happening with the Marlin, because it's so unreliable in terms of when the season starts. And since then, we've been in touch with them. We met them last year. We spent a few days there sort of going through what we were interested in and hearing what they were interested in and seeing where the overlap might be. And it's been amazing. So like I mentioned before, we've got colleagues there that are working on things like phytoplankton, which is obviously fundamental to the fishery there, which is obviously the herring and the sardines, which is what the marlin are feeding on. So understanding that aspect from the very, very sort of bottom up is really important to understanding what's happening at the ecological level. So even just on a, you know, ethics aside, that you shouldn't just turn up and pretend like you know everything. It's so important, I think, to have these sort of on the ground relationships with the local scientists, but also local fisheries, people that live in the area, rely on these environments for their livelihood, because it gives you so much more information. And it's been really, really beneficial for us just to understand the system as a whole. Like, we could never understand that on our own. We only spend sort of a couple of weeks there a year. So it's been invaluable for us to have that information.
So you briefly touched on it would be interesting to see kind of how this current El Nino from this year has impacted it. But is there another future for the research group? Like, what is there any further projects coming up?
Yeah, so we had an actual fun project on the side when we were sort of trying to work out different ways to pull out these tracks, which has been a really long process. We sort of noticed in the drone footage, we saw some colour-changing aspects of the marlin. So we'd always heard from the locals and the fishermen and things that the marlin light up when they get excited. So I'm not sure if you've seen a marlin, for those listening, that's the stripe pattern down the side caused by iridophores, which are sort of bright blue colour cells in the skin, that they light up when they get excited. Well, that's what we were told by fishermen and so forth. And what we saw from the drone footage from the first time was that they actually light up when they attack a school. You can see it really clearly from the drone footage, which is the first time we've really ever seen it sort of as this temporal aspect of turning on and then off again. So that's sort of a side project that we just sort of noticed in the last couple of weeks, which led us to a project. We actually went to Malaysia last week, still fresh and jet lagged, where we're seeing if this is actually a common approach used by billfish to attack other schools. So this idea of colour change in a topwater predator is actually really unique. We know that things like cuttlefish and cephalopod and things change colour and manipulate their colour to attack prey, but we've never really seen it in a predator that's firstly in a group, but also a predator that's a big sort of pelagic fish. So so we're starting to have a look more into that, which is a bit of a fun project. But also an important one. If there's another aspect of the billfish that we just don't even know about. So we're starting to look at things like swordfish, sailfish, see if they do it as well, which would be really interesting. Yeah.
That's amazing. And probably too early to say, but do you have any thoughts about whether they're signaling to each other or trying to confuse the prey?
Yeah, really good question. So we don't know is the short answer. We think that it's probably both. It's probably evolved as a signal to their conspecific. So as you can imagine, it's a very fast-moving, dynamic system, but the marlin actually attack one at a time. So when they're attacking the bait school, one will go in, make a few attempts, and then leave, or it might be cut off by another one. And we think maybe this is a potential signal to their group mates that they're about to go next. But on the other end, it could also be for the prey school as well. So we know that this sort of striped patterning can be used to disrupt sort of flicker frequency in the eyes of prey. So it could be a technique to maybe disrupt the schooling behavior just for a split second so they can make a capture, or it could just be both. So it's a really exciting topic, actually. It's a new one for me, color, but yeah, it could be anything. It's really exciting.
Do you have a favorite marine creature? And is that related to a particular behavior?
Well, that's such a good question. I always think about this and it always changes, but I think what I always come back to is the shrimp goby. That's my favorite. It's a little goby that lives on Barrier Reef and probably most reefs around the world, actually. And it has a little shrimp mutualist friend, and they live together in a burrow. So it's a really cool little system. So this is another sort of side project that I just looked upon when I was doing my PhD just for fun. But what you see in this little shrimp goby is basically this really unique mutualism on the reef, where you've got a shrimp and a goby living together in a little burrow, and they live together for life. And what happens is the shrimp is blind and it builds its burrow, and then the goby basically is its lookout. It uses the goby's eyes so it can go out and forage, and then the goby gets a free home out of it. Really, really cool system. And I think it's my favorite because when you go to a coral reef, it's so dazzling. It's so beautiful. There's so many things flying past your face all the time. But occasionally people just don't look down and look at the sand. And if you look down at the sand, even just for a few minutes, all of a sudden you'll see it's just completely alive. There's things everywhere. And these shrimp gobies were sort of that realization for me. I just looked down and there were suddenly I just could see them everywhere, and they were all over the place. And it was sort of, they were so easy to miss, but so interesting behaviorally, where they have this sort of mutualism going on. So I think that's my favorite, the unsung heroes, those two.
Alicia, you talked about your route into your current career, and it wasn't a sort of straight line, but what advice would you have for a young person who's looking for a career in marine biology?
Yeah, I think the advice that I would give, and I guess it's based on what I've done, is just to take your time. I don't think, I was always under the impression that, oh, I was getting too old, I was too late, I was sort of taking sort of different routes to different things, and not going down that straight line sort of undergrad, postgrad, marine biologist way. There are many different ways to become a marine biologist, I guess, is the answer to that. And don't be discouraged. Take your time to find out what you're interested in. It's such a big world. There are so many amazing things to study, not just the animals, but the physical side as well. So I would, just talk to people. Don't be afraid to reach out to scientists as well. I was definitely afraid for years. I was too scared to sort of cold call or email people. I didn't want to bother people. But that's the way you sort of find out things. And people are always so nice when you finally do it, even if they don't have opportunities that, you know, they can take you along to field courses or things like that. They'll always point you in the right direction. So if you find something interesting, definitely just email someone and ask them about it. That's definitely the way to go. And don't be discouraged if you're sort of not entirely sure where you want to go. That's where I was for years. But I just, I traveled and I talked to people and I sort of whittled it down until I found what I was interested in, which I'm super lucky now that I can do that as a job.
Yeah, that's a really useful few points there. Thank you very much, Alicia. That was fascinating, and it's such a great compliment to the article you wrote and the work of your team to have a bit more detail and to talk about this amazing work. So thank you again, Alicia. And you can, just to remind you, you can catch up with all the Marine Biologist podcasts on our Spotify site or via the MBA website at www.mba.ac.uk. Thanks again. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been the Marine Biologist podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please check out our other episodes. Please subscribe to our podcast. Please rate it, share it with your friends and family, and let us know what you think. And we will look forward to welcoming you to the next episode soon. Take care.